Hello, I'm Monsignor Jim Lasanti. Today, on Personally Speaking, I'll be joined by the two-time Tony nominee and celebrated director Michael Arden. Michael recently directed a new film version of A Christmas Carol. Please stay with us. Hello and welcome to Personally Speaking. I'm your host, Monsignor Jim Lasanti. And Tony-nominated director Michael Arden joins me now. Michael launched his career on Broadway as an actor before moving into his current role as a groundbreaking director. He made his Broadway debut as a performer in Def West's Big River, playing Tom Sawyer. And he made his directorial debut with the 2015 revival of Spring Awakening, which earned him his first Tony nomination. He received his second Tony nomination for directing the Tony winner for Best Revival of a Musical, Once on This Island. Michael's theater career actually began when he was a 10-year-old Texan playing Tiny Tim in the Midland Community Theater production of A Christmas Carol. And he recently directed a new, critically acclaimed film production of A Christmas Carol. This film version of Charles Dickens' holiday classic stars Tony Award winner Jefferson Mays, who plays over 50 roles in a production unlike any other. A Christmas Carol is streaming worldwide to benefit partner theaters around the country affected by the pandemic. And Michael's here with us today to tell us more about that, about his life, his career, and the values that matter the most to him. Joining me now, I'm very pleased to welcome to Personally Speaking the acclaimed director and actor, Michael Arden. Michael, with both my parish as well as people online, I'm regularly recommending that they see the 1951 Alistair Sim version of A Christmas Carol. But now I'm directing them to see Michael Arden's A Christmas Carol. Tell me your history with Charles Dickens' story and how you came to be attached. And am I right that at one point in your life, you actually played Tiny Tim?
Yeah, well, that was my first probably introduction. Was playing Tiny Tim. I think before that I had seen the Mickey's Christmas Carol, probably on loop, every year when I was even younger. But when I was in the fifth grade, I was cast as Tiny Tim in my local Midland, Texas community theater production of Christmas Carol. Okay. I was very plump Tiny Tim at the time. So I want to just take this moment to apologize to Ronnie Williams, who played Bob Cratchit, who had to carry me around on his probably broken back. But yeah, it was, and I ended up doing that production that they did every year for several years in a row, playing different roles as I grew older, and then ended up doing the show in a regional theater later on. And it's just been a story that I've loved forever. I love what Dickens was getting at, and his reasons for writing it, and his sort of indictment of you know, capitalist society in it, and mm-hmm. how we have to sort of all Christmas long, but I mean all year long, but especially mm-hmm. Christmas, look at how we are living our lives, how we are treating those, and you know, making sure that we see our fellow men as he puts it, fellow passengers to the grave, and not people who are below us based on socioeconomic standing or anything else for that matter. So I think it's a really important story. I've always loved mm-hmm. the language, always loved the point of it. And, you know, I love that it's scary and it's funny and it's redemptive all in one.
You know, the reviewers that I've read not only love your direction, but of course they're mesmerized by Jefferson Mays, the actor. Did you know him before you directed him in this?
No, I met him through this project. I had been an enormous fan of his. I'd seen him on Broadway in I Am My Own Wife, as well as Gentleman's Guide to Love and Murder, as well as Oslo, as well as Pygmalion. I'd really seen him on stage a lot at Journey's End, but I had never gotten the chance to meet him or work with him. So, when the artistic director of the Geffen Playhouse in LA suggested I meet him to talk about this project, he sort of was our matchmaker in this. I was thrilled, and we sat down to lunch, and by the end of it, we were thick as thieves, as you might say.
Michael Arden is known as a director as someone with deep empathy for the actors, and I want to divert for a second. We had on the show last year Christopher Gattelli, the great choreographer. He said that he thinks he comes with an extra blessing because he not only is going to be choreographing people, but he has been a dancer who tried to get jobs, and that made him sensitive to those who don't get jobs. Michael, you're not just a director, but you've been an actor for so long. How does that impact on you hiring, firing, and working with actors?
Well, I know what it's like to be on the other side of that table. You know, I think it's incredibly scary sometimes to be an actor. You know, you're a lot of times an artist makes a piece of art, and if people don't like it, you know, you can say, oh, they didn't like the thing I made. But as an actor, if, you know, the scrutiny is on you, so it's like, oh, they might not like me, or will they like me? And I think that's an incredibly vulnerable position to be in. And so I have such great respect for what actors do, you know, to really let themselves be their work. So I always want to make sure that they feel as safe as possible, that they feel as respected as possible. Because at the end of the day, especially in theater, you know, they're the ones running the show. They're the ones telling the story and making things happen. And so it's my job to create an environment in which they can do their best work and feel as comfortable and safe and supported as possible. So,
Michael, in your earlier life before directing, when you were more active in acting, how did you personally handle, so many actors say they go through this experience of knowing they're perfect for a role but don't get it. How did you handle disappointment or rejection?
Well, it's certainly not easy. You know, it's, I think, and I'm asked this question by a lot of young actors all the time, like, you know, how do you deal with the rejection, or, you know, which is constant, you know, because you might be right for the part, but they might have already hired someone to play your co-star who's too tall to make sense with you, or, you know, there's so much that's out of your control that you have to have an extreme confidence in your ability and a willingness to kind of let things go, let be and let God, as it were. And, you know, I think having a good support system of people who know what it's like, of other artists, having your tribe, as it were, is really important. And you know, knowing that someone's giving you a job or not is actually not an indication of your self-worth, which is a constant practice in reminding yourself that. I mean, it's certainly not easy allowing yourself to be really upset for a day, but then moving on, you know, because there've been roles that I have been perfect for that I didn't get. And, you know, it's about how we, life, my husband says to me, life is about the graceful execution of plan B, you know, and I find that very comforting, sometimes, but it's not easy, but having people you can commiserate with and who support you and who you in turn support, in those difficult times is, I think, really important.
You've mentioned Andy Mantis, who you're sharing your life with, and I wanted to stop on something that he shared with us on our program earlier. We talked about when parents find out, grandparents find out that, you know, their child is gay, how should they react? And I had used the words tolerance, acceptance, and he said that they were probably condescending words, that the proper approach should be not acceptance or tolerance, but embrace. Your own insight, especially on a show like this, Michael, because there are so many parents and grandparents who listen to a program like this, what should a parent or grandparent do when son or daughter says, I've got something to tell you?
Well, I think, you know, when there's something to tell you, it's not new information. It's not like a decision. It's not a decision has been made at that moment. It's a moment in saying, at this moment in my life, either I think you need this information to know me more fully, or I need to share this information so that I can live my life transparently and more honestly. So, you know, it's not like there's some like new thing that is appearing. It's just about this idea of moving toward a more honest and open relationship. Mm-hmm. So in a way, I think there should be celebration in that. It's like when someone comes out to you, they are telling you, I love you enough to share my entire life with you and to not edit who I am for you, because I want to give all of myself to you. Mm. And I trust you with that information. So I think it's about support. It's about supporting, embracing is a great word. And you know, I remember the first person I ever came out to was my English teacher in ninth grade. Okay. She asked us on our first day of ninth grade to write an essay about what we learned about ourselves over the summer. And I had had her also in sixth grade as my English teacher. It was a private Episcopal school that I attended. And I wrote in the essay that I had sort of come to terms with the fact that I was gay. And, you know, I had known that for a while, but I shared it for the first time. And she came up to me after class and called me aside. And she said, I read your paper and I feel so grateful that you would think enough of me to show me who you are completely. And I think that set a precedent where I felt then no shame.
Right.
Which, you know, shame is the opposite of love and creation. You know, shame is what we feel when we put other people's fears above our own truth. Mm-hmm. So I think that really was incredibly important. And I wish that type of experience for everyone who wants to be seen, because that's all it is. Everyone wants to be seen and loved. And sometimes fear gets in the way. You know, fear is the opposite, is the inverse of love. So just lead with love and support. It's not about accepting. I mean, they're not a different person.
Right.
They've actually letting you love more of them.
Okay. Now, for those listening to Michael Arden, you might think when a guy has had this kind of a well put together life that he comes from a very easy circumstance. That's not true. Michael's mom had special challenges. His dad died when Michael was young. But Michael, important in your life, I know, Jim and Pat Moore, your grandparents, what, when you look back on your early life with their care, what did they do right?
Oh, goodness. I mean, so many things, you know, that become more and more clear in retrospect. You know, they're no longer with us. These are my grandparents who raised me for the most part. But they really supported my dreams. You know, they even if they didn't understand them, I mean, they were two folks from the South who knew nothing about the arts, you know, who worked on airplanes and lived in Midland, Texas almost their entire life. So for them to make the sacrifices they did and to support me in both a career and a life that they probably never quite understood, and yet put my happiness and acknowledged that I could understand my happiness more than they could. That was an incredible gift. You know, they made sure I got the education that I felt I wanted. And when I ended up dropping out of college, they supported me in that, even though I know they were terrified about it, you know? I feel incredibly blessed to have had them in my life for the time I did and continue to, and I continue to, you know, I find them in everyday occurrences, you know, that they are the values that they instilled in me and the support they gave for me makes me want to do the same for others. And that's legacy.
Did I read rightly that you lost them both the same year?
I did. Yes.
Wow. Okay. That's quite a hit on such a loving relationship. That's
it was a rough year. My grandfather had a stroke, and while I flew back, and while he was in the hospital, like the next day, my grandmother had an embolism and died quite suddenly. Luckily, I was with her at the moment when it happened. Wow. And then he suffered, because of his stroke, he became aphasic. And so it was almost a year later, he passed away. He also was battling cancer too. So It was quite a year. 2012 was quite a year. Everyone talked about how that was going to be the end of the world, and I often joke that in many ways it was for me. You know, it was the end of the world as I knew it at that time. So,
you know, in reading about them, Michael, I had read about their own Southern Baptist background, and I was reminded a few months ago we did an interview with Brian J. Smith, a Broadway actor, and he was raised in Texas and raised in a Southern Baptist family. But he said he sat in church year after year hearing that he was someone who was God's mistake because he was gay.
Right.
That didn't happen for you.
Well, you know, I started to feel that way in the Southern Baptist church. And yeah, maybe it was because of people like Shelley Hickman, that English teacher, but I said, you know what? I think I need to find a new church. And I did. I started attending United Methodist Church by myself.
Wow.
For the next like 5 years when I was in Texas, and was incredibly involved there. And I felt like, you know, here was a place where I could exercise my faith and be around people. So I sort of just was like, yeah, you know what? I'm gonna change my subscription here. because I wanted to be where I felt like I was uplifted.
And for Christian churches around the country, especially who listen to a program like this, what should our disposition be and our spirit of welcome be for everyone?
I mean, I think we have to, you know, behave as we have to be Christ-like. I think that is we have to remember that the church was founded upon those principles. You know, Christ had Mary Magdalene in his company. No one was without sin, and no one is without sin. So you know, it's not about loving the sinner, hating the sin. It's about finding common ground and wanting to live our lives lead by example. So that is, I think what we must do, and that everyone is on a different journey. And for anyone to claim that they know the right or wrong way to live is hubris in a way. So I think like all we can do is, you know, what would Jesus do? He would welcome, which, getting back to Christmas Carol, is a bit of what Dickens was about.
That's
like,
right.
You know, like we should be compelled to reach our hand out even when it is scary. And usually fear is just because we haven't lived in the shoes of the person that we are afraid of. If we have that empathy and compassion and can imagine ourselves outside of ourselves, then it might be easier to extend a hand.
I think Michael's onto something. His A Christmas Carol is in some ways the very embodiment of the Christian message, as is, I think, the movie It's a Wonderful Life. The going back to parents and the way people raise us and stuff, have you ever had the opportunity to literally save a life by being able to talk to parents and help them to understand that their kid is their kid no matter what? Always
our
children?
I don't know if I have in terms like that, you know, where a parent has like reached out to me. However, I try to talk like we are now as much as I can, because, you know, I know when I came out to my grandparents, that was really difficult for them, and it was because they had lived in a generation and didn't have exposure or experience or didn't know who to ask or what to listen to. So I think, you know, the more open I can be about my experience, and you know, that we send information on these airwaves like we're doing now, and this might help someone, you know, because it's usually just ignorance and fear, and ignorance not in a malicious way, but just in a like, what would a straight person like know about being gay? You know, of course not. Yeah. So it seems scary. Like I go to a foreign country and I don't speak the language. It's a little scary. You know, that doesn't mean that I'm wrong or they're wrong. It's just, it is what it is. And so you know, hopefully
helping people understand. One of the guests we had a while back was Stephen Schwartz, the composer, and going to your point about doing some shopping for a spiritual home, I said, why would you, as a secular Jewish man, aside from Pippin and Wicked and things like that, why would your first musical be Godspell about Jesus? And he said, you don't have to be Christian to know that the world would be in much better shape if people actually tried to live by the teachings of Jesus. And you're saying that's what every church should be.
Yeah, I mean, I think so. It's about seeing where there is want and need mm-hmm. and pain and trying to fill it with love and acceptance and finding a way that we might move forward for a better tomorrow, which isn't about exclusion.
Ebenezer Scrooge, for our guests, who the one person in the world who doesn't know A Christmas Carol story, has a transformation, a conversion that opens up his heart. I mention that in this context. I'm reading about you, Michael, and this is what somebody says, that you have a servant's heart. And they specifically talk about the fact that you've dedicated yourself so often to giving back for all you've received. He's performed several fundraisers to support and benefit World AIDS Day, Covenant House, Broadway Cares, Equity Fights AIDS, St. Vincent's School in Haiti, as well as directing those who are especially challenged. Where is the empathy or compassion in you from that allows you to say, I'm glad I've been blessed, I'm glad I've been successful, but I'm obligated to give back?
I mean, I would be nowhere had people not given to me. So, you know, I don't know. I think service is, as an artist, especially, we are, that is our calling. I mean, you know, it is a service. We have a gift that has been given to us and that has been allowed, that people have allowed us to nurture throughout our career, you know, that, so I feel like it's important that be shared and given back. And I use that, you know, in the sense of greater good. I think artists are here to heal the world and help people understand themselves better so that they might, you know, live more honest lives. So I feel that artists are, you know, we're soldiers. In a way, and so it's just as a soldier in a military might feel it is their duty to serve and protect, it is my duty to give and to share and to inspire hope and to help people hold a mirror to nature so people can understand themselves better so that they might lead with love.
For our listeners around the country, around the world, Michael Arden has directed a new version of A Christmas Carol that people can get through streaming. Michael, for our listeners, how specifically should they get on board to watch and see this new production?
So there are a few ways you can do it. You can go to achristmascarollive.com, which is our website for the piece. But also, I think about like 75 regional and community theaters around the United States are offering it through their own subscription services, through their own websites, and at least half of the ticket price goes directly to that theater who might not be able to present their live version of Christmas Carol this year. But also money still goes from, it's sort of apples and oranges. You can either go to A Christmas Carol mm-hmm. Live or if there is a theater that you often frequent, you might check in and see if they might be offering it. I believe there's a list of theaters on our website. But that's how you do, and you buy the stream, and you're sent an email, and then you have a link, and you can stream it to your TV. I would recommend watching it in the dark with the sound turned up. It is a ghost story after all. So
timeless,
but definitely you want to get yourself in the mood to be visited by spirits, just like Scrooge.
Now let me ask you, Michael. Once the season is over, is it possible that this might be available on DVD?
I think there it is very possible. We actually, this version that is being streamed right now is very much a capture of the play version. Mm-hmm. But we also, at the same time, made a more filmic version, which we'll be editing come January, that will be more of a film, but still using elements of the stage production that hopefully will be available year after year after this. And hopefully we'll be back in theaters, knock on wood, starting next year, and people will have the option to do that, the greatest of all things, which is come to the theater and, yeah, and you know, feel the vibrations of the actor from the stage in their seat.
Are you a man of hope?
Yes, I think so. Some days. I mean, it's a practice and an exercise. Mm-hmm. I wouldn't consider myself just like, oh yeah, I'm hopeful. It's like hope is a active, yes, you have to work at it.
And it's
not a passive exercise. It takes you making sure that other people have hope as well.
Okay. I think one of the ways folks can find hope, and I'm going to encourage people who are listening to this program to embrace Michael Arden's A Christmas Carol. If you're not a hopeful person by the end of watching Ebenezer Scrooge go through his personal conversion, then you may be hopeless, but no one is.
Michael, well, you know, or maybe it just takes a few times, you know. I think that's why we come back to it year after year.
I want to thank Michael Arden for being with us. I want to thank him for putting together this magnificent A Christmas Carol. As I said early in the show, I had always been addicted to the 1951 Alistair Sim version. I'm now addicted to Michael Arden's version. And I think people get to see it, they will be too. Michael, thanks for your creative gifts and sharing them. And thanks for being so open and honest with us today. And personally speaking, we are grateful for you as our guest.
Well, thank you so much for having me. And I hope everyone has a wonderful, safe holiday season. Please wear your masks and huddle close to the ones you love and watch A Christmas Carol, hopefully.
Will do. Merry Christmas, Michael. Thank you.
You too. Bye-bye.
As we end today's program, I want to thank all of you for being with us. If you have any questions or comments about the show, you can send them to me through my website, which is www.closeencountertv.com. All one word, closeencountertv.com. To listen to our Personally Speaking podcast with some of our most recent shows, please go to YouTube and search under Personally Speaking with Monsignor Jim Lasanti and subscribe. Personally Speaking is also available as a podcast on Apple Podcasts, iHeart, and Spotify. You can also listen to past episodes by going to www.ollmp.org, and you get not only recent shows, but also Monsignor Jim's weekly homilies. I'm privileged to serve as host and executive producer, Personally Speaking. Our producer is Lisa Jadovitz. And thank you all so much for being with us. We'll be with you again next time on Personally Speaking.